Hello.
Hey.
Welcome to Rosé and DNA. I'm Deanna.
And I'm Renee. And we're two professionals working in the field of genetics.
Well, listeners, we are just so excited to start off season three. We first of all want to thank everyone for their patience. Deanna and I actually took the advice of some of our speakers and podcast guests over the last couple of years and really heeded that advice to take some time for ourselves and take care of ourselves and pursue some of our own professional growth opportunities. So it's been a really exciting year for both of us. And so we're just happy that we're getting back into this and talking to some of our most favorite people, especially today, our guest, actually one of the first people that we told this idea for this podcast, several years ago while we were at a conference. So our favorite person in the world, Marianne Campion, is here today. And we're just really excited to get to know her on an even deeper level and hear about her fabulous career and what her plans are moving forward. But some little background on Marianne for maybe the few people who don't know her or haven't heard of her. She is an educator, a genetic counselor, mentor, mom, et cetera, et cetera. She has her PhD in education from Boston University. I believe that's in educational leadership and policy. Is that correct?
That's right.
MS from the University of South Carolina in genetic counseling, went to Furman University to get a degree, a BS degree in psychology, so many other things. She's the founding director of the genetic counseling program at the Boston University School of Medicine, which happens to be where Deanna and I graduated from. Currently the director of the MS program in human genetics and genetic counseling and clinical professor in the Department of Genetics at Stanford University. And her career has focused mostly on prenatal counseling and education. So she served in this capacity in prenatal counseling with the Greenwood Genetics Center and then 12 years at Boston Medical Center. In addition to all of these things, she served or led many GC-related committees. I think pretty much at this point, everyone in the field knows her. So thank you so much for being a guest. We just are so excited to get started.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, before we kick it off, something we always like to do, just because, you know, Rosé and DNA, it's the name of the podcast. We like to just quickly mention what we're having to drink today. And if you're not having like wine, you can also say that. But yeah, Renee, what are you having?
Well, I broke out a real special one today, and I've actually been saving this bottle, which I don't know, it's a rosé, and I think we learned that rosé shouldn't really be aged, but I've been saving it for this episode. I'm sure our friend Emily will tell us that that's not the good thing to do, but she actually happened to be the person who gave me this bottle. One of our, Deanna and my classmates, is married to someone who whose family owns Robert Young Winery or Vineyards in Geyserville, California, I believe it's technically located there. And so the bottle that I have today is called Rachel's Rosé. And this is actually the wine created by Emily's sister-in-law. So this is a really special one. And we actually know Rachel at this point pretty well. And so on the back, it says this is the first wine created by sixth generation Rachel Taylor. And it's homage to her great-great-great-grandmother, Rachel Young, who homesteaded in the Young Ranch in 1858. So that's cool. Quite a legacy. But I think just, again, appropriate for this podcast because I looked it up and the stats are 82.2% of winemakers are men. So I'm really honored to be able to highlight a woman, young woman winemaker. So I am drinking this and it is so good.
We're also forgetting it's one of the most important wines because it's the winery where we decided on the podcast. We like came up with this podcast idea when we were at a wedding at that vineyard. So super, super special.
Yeah. How about you?
Well, I'm not drinking wine today, but I'm drinking Down East Cider. from Boston. I was like, I didn't have any special wines that I wanted to crack open, but I found Down East in Buffalo, New York, where I am right now. And I just was like so shocked that I could find it in a store. So decided to open that today. And yeah, it's a craft cider place in Boston. And it just reminds me of being in Boston where we all met and decided that would be the most appropriate for today. Marianne, we see a coffee mug over there.
Yep, representing Boston with my JC mug here. I'm not currently drinking wine. I am having a golden latte, so some turmeric, ginger, cayenne, nice little mid-afternoon delight. But when I do drink wine, I do want to give a shout out to my favorite, which is Troika. It's in Sonoma, and it's a family-owned winery that just goes so far beyond profits. They really got to know me and a group of friends a few years ago, and then when I was ill, they reached out to check in, and I just love what they do for their customers and their community. So Hi to the Troika crew.
I love that about that area. I think it's so family oriented. Like every vineyard that you go to out there just has such like a rich story about how they don't just like take care of their community or take care of their people, but their community and all of that. So I feel like that's such a special thing that you learn if anyone ever gets the chance to go up to the Sonoma area.
So true.
Shall we jump into it then? Get down to the dirty deets?
Thanks. Fire away.
All right. So something we always love to ask our guests, because most often, even if we know them pretty well, we still don't know about, you know, how they grew up and about some of those like early formative experiences. So what would you like to share about, you know, how you were growing up as a child, if you had any like particularly important experiences that sort of shaped who you are today?
Sure. Well, let's start just by saying I am a white, cisgender, heterosexual female, highly educated, currently able-bodied U.S. citizen. So clearly I'm the recipient of immeasurable unearned privilege, and that undoubtedly impacts everything else you'll hear. So important to start with that piece. I grew up in a small town north of Atlanta called Gainesville, Georgia, and I had the benefit of having very loving, engaged parents, but also pretty hands-off. And I think that has shaped a lot of how I, in turn, have mentored over the years. And my parents, their motto in life was participate. So they made sure we just kind of put ourselves out there. And if things went well, we could be proud of that. And if things didn't go so great, we had to get ourselves out of trouble. And I like that. I think it helped me develop some agency and self-efficacy. And a large part of my personality also probably comes from being a lifelong summer camp aficionado. I think I started at age 6 and by maybe 10 or 12 was going 8 weeks a summer.
Wow.
I know. Small camp in the mountains of Asheville, North Carolina. To this day, I still love the place and the people that were there. And it just made me like try a lot of new things, put myself out there, not take myself too seriously, you know, make new friends, but keep the old. That is still how I feel like I kind of navigate the world today. So definitely consider myself a Southerner by birth and by heart and soul, and then a summer camper indeed.
And when you were growing up, was studying science or going into STEM one of those early goals, or is that something you kind of stumbled on through your education?
Stumbled on for sure. So I went to a small liberal arts school in South Carolina and happened to sit beside a really nice fellow biochemistry student who was a year older. Her name was Claire Singletary. She's now the director of the genetic counseling program at University of Texas. And she told me about, I know, crazy, right?
Small world.
She told me about this organization called Greenwood Genetic Center. And she said, I'm going to do a summer internship there. And I think it'd be really fun. And we had taken psychology classes together too. And I was probably 19 and had no idea what I was going to do other than be a summer camp counselor. So I signed up and the rest is history.
Wow. That is, I know. I did not know that. That is so cool. So what was it like interning there? I feel like a lot of folks in the genetic counseling field have heard about Greenwood Genetic Center in some way or another. What was it like in those years?
Yeah, great question. So I don't know if you know much about the state of South Carolina, but the state is pretty small and then Greenwood is really small. So it is certainly a organization that isn't necessarily on most people's geographic radar, but I think it is scientifically and clinically. It's definitely a family feel. So the medical geneticists, the genetic counselors, all of the lab scientists take really good care of each other. And I think I just thought if this signifies what it would be like to work in the genetic space in the future, then sign me up. And it was great. I got to see a lot. You know, back then there weren't many specialties within genetic counseling. So all of the genetic counselors were either doing pediatrics or a few doing prenatal, and that was it. But the clinicians and researchers were certainly thinking about what else might arise down the road. And I liked that innovation piece. I think ultimately that's why I picked genetic counseling, because I liked the idea of not having to worry about ever feeling stagnant or bored, or that my learning would plateau and end, because it was very clear that in genetics it was going to continue to evolve forever. And that was appealing.
I feel like that's so many people's answer to that question, is just like genetics is always changing. There's so many things to learn. And yeah, like you can sort of never predict the future in this field, which is really exciting. But I guess like just jumping forward a few years after you, you know, went through genetic counseling and had your first job at Greenwood for a few years, it was only a couple of years after you were out of your training that you decided to even like move even further and jump and learn a lot more than just, you know, how to be a good genetic counselor. You actually started the BU program. So I guess two questions there. One, how did you end up in Boston? Like, was it something about the city or just kind of like luck of the draw that you ended up there? And, you know, like, what was it about like starting a program that was interesting to you?
Yeah, such a good question too, because I think back then it really was a lot of right place, right time. I loved my job at Greenwood, but I was ready to try a new part of the country. And I was looking all over, but my brother had gone to grad school in Boston, so at least that was a city that I had heard of. And so I started applying to jobs there, and then maybe a year into even considering leaving the Southeast, a position popped up at Boston University where they were looking to start a genetic counseling training program. And, you know, by all means, the opportunity came earlier than I expected, but I didn't want to regret watching it pass me by. And I figured, what did I have to lose? So I applied and got it. I've often been asked, like, why do I think that I was offered the job? And the cynical part of me thinks it was probably because they knew I had a ton of time and energy and I would put in the work. And I think in a lot of ways, my naivety did pay off in that sense. But I certainly wasn't trying to fool anyone, including myself, that I had all the answers. I knew I did not. So when I even considered it, the first person I reached out to was the director of the genetic counseling training program I attended. So University of South Carolina, wanted to get her thoughts. And she pulled my personal statement from when I had applied. And she said, well, you know, you talked about wanting to be a program director. And I didn't remember that. But apparently on some subconscious level, I had always known that getting into the education lane was something that appealed to me. So that was a nice conversation. She asked all sorts of really insightful, important questions. And then I reached out to the director of the training program at Brandeis, because that was the other one in New England at the time. And again, had a very earnest and important conversation with her, and then ultimately decided to take the leap. But then even once I arrived, the biggest hurdle was just numbers. There were only two other genetic counselors at BU at the time. And in a short amount of time, we hired three more. And I realized that six might still sound small, but to this day, that was the most creative, innovative, fun group I've ever worked with. And I think we just decided, let's do this. So we reached out to every genetic counselor we could find in the greater Boston area and asked if anybody was interested in getting involved in a new program. And slowly but surely, enough people raised their hand and we got to work.
Wow.
It's kind of funny to hear you say that, like, it was like you were like naive or something going into the experience and like you think that that's why they took a chance on you. I actually relate to that a lot in my first job. But it is like, it's so true, right? Like if you don't, if you're young and you're eager, like you probably have a really good chance of being successful at most jobs just because you're so willing to like put in the time and work and get it to where it needs to be.
Yeah.
And I'll add, I wasn't afraid of it failing. To me, that was totally fine as an option. I figured, let's give it a shot and see what happens. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But I wasn't afraid of getting started and then discovering it wasn't going to work and then feeling completely disappointed. Wow. Yeah. I figured the challenge and the journey would be in and of itself pretty fun to go through. So I think that helped that, you know, what, let's see what happens.
Well, I love that mentality because I feel like it's taken me a lot of therapy to like not be afraid of failing. I feel like that, I mean, failure is such a big fear. I think of a lot of people who have, you know, gone into this field or really so many, really anything. Failure is just one of those like deep fears that I think a lot of human beings have just naturally. So that's fascinating to me that at that young of an age, you were already at that place where you could take on this huge thing that to me would just be like, that would, my first thought I think at that point would be, I can't fail. That's the one thing that I can't do. But I'm sure that that mentality was really what allowed you. And it's that, I don't know, you give off that kind of very comforting, I don't know, just aura.
Like reassuring.
That, yeah, reassuring that I think helps people believe in you, whatever you really are going to do next, whatever you're going to say. So that actually is so interesting to me that, you know, even then that was kind of what you were all about.
Well, I feel like sometimes the bigger things like that are actually less scary from a failure standpoint, at least for me, because it seemed so out there and slightly outlandish to be doing something like that with only a few years under my belt.
Yeah.
So I didn't think the world really expected me to succeed. And if I did, then great. But if I didn't, so be it. And sometimes the shorter term goals or the smaller goals are actually more intimidating to me because I think the world is certainly expecting me to deliver in this capacity.
So wise.
So if we were to compare like that year one to how you lead now as a program director, I'm sure there are so many lessons you've learned along the way. And I'm sure we'll get into some of those. But I guess what would be kind of one of those fundamental differences in that first year? Well, actually, I'm sure the first year you didn't even have a class. It was, you know, building out the program. But those first years compared to now.
Yeah. So speaking of not having a program yet, I do remember the very first admissions day, and this was back before the match. So this was when we made phone calls to people. And I will never forget the very first applicant who said yes to our offer. And I thought, I've got a class, even if it's just one student, I've got a class. And it's funny.
Can you shout him out?
Christina Choi. She was the very first person that ever accepted. Although Samantha Baxter would tell you she's my very first graduate, which is true because her last name was the first and alphabetically. So both of them can claim that. But it was one of those moments where I thought, okay, well, now the curtain is rising and the show's going on. But I had 2 years to prepare for that moment. And I think that was a really big help. Mm-hmm. But as far as what has changed from then to now, I'd say the biggest piece is that I just work smarter, not harder. Again, thinking back to that boundless energy that I poured into developing the BU program, it's been replaced by the realities of aging, right? Like my mental and physical capacity is not what it was 20 years ago, but I probably have more perspective wisdom and a little bit better about knowing when enough is enough and what to say yes and no to. I'm less conflict averse now. I'm more willing to have hard conversations and be vulnerable about my own weaknesses. So those are probably some of the big differences.
Yeah. Now, I really appreciated even like when we reached out to you for this podcast, you were like, okay, like what's the time commitment and like how can I work this in so that I'm not like feeling rushed? And I don't know. I personally feel like I'm still at that phase where I'm like, I just have to say yes to everything. And we've talked about this so many times on the podcast, but like that ability to say no or just like really say yes to the things that you really, really want to say yes to is so important. And I know like even sort of related to this, I don't know if I've actually heard it from you or from like someone else that's heard it from you, but your motto being like do, delegate, delete.
Yeah.
Is that really how you do it?
It is. So that was actually the first strategy I employed. And it certainly didn't originate with me, but I heard it from somewhere and thought, ooh, brilliant. And the origin behind that is to not read emails more than once. The idea that you open your emails and with every single one, you either do it or you delete it or you delegate it to someone else. So that was the first thing I did to try to streamline efforts. But there are a lot of other strategies I've added since then, including the one I used with deciding whether to do this podcast. It's called the 72-hour rule. So it's the idea that anything that doesn't fit into your job description or your personal responsibilities, do not say yes or no for 72 hours. And that one has really paid off too. But I've got some other gems. You want to hear a few more?
Yeah.
So one of my favorites is the 3 P's. So if you are going to say yes to something, it better have 2 of the following 3: good pay, a good project, or good people. And I would argue that when you're further in your career, it should really be all 3. But I think even early on, if it's not checking 2 of those boxes, it's probably not going to be something that really aligns with your personal passions or career goals. So the 3 P's, I love that one. Probably my favorite is called JOMO. Have you heard of this one?
No.
Okay. Certainly, you know, FOMO, right? Fear of missing out. JOMO is the joy of missing out. So it's the idea that let's say I'm asked to give a talk on a Friday night and I'm hemming and hawing about whether I should do it. Then what I need to do first is to picture myself on a Friday night without that talk. So I'm going to picture myself in my pajamas, on the couch with my family and my dog, eating takeout, watching a movie. And the joy that will wash over me as I envision life without this presentation will be what allows me to say no.
Oh, I love that. Because I think that one actually resonates with me most. Because it's so easy to just say yes and imagine. And sometimes with those things that you say yes to, they're so minuscule in the grand scheme of things, or it's a one-liner on a CV that no one's really ever going to look at or care that much about. But like the stress of, you know, if you take a talk as an example, you know, how many hours would I spend creating? It's not just the 1 hour or whatever you're giving the talk.
It's That's right.
The mental energy working up to it. So, to even extend that, it's not just that one night eating takeout, right? It's like how many more hours outside of that is it going to take from your joy?
Just curious. Have you always like known your value? Because like I feel like to be able to say like this fits into – all of these buckets like takes a lot of work to be like, I have this really high value that I bring to the table and this is how I can say no. Like, I guess, was there ever like a point where you felt like you didn't have that or like you noticed a shift or like, is that just always something that was sort of innate for you?
Well, that's kind of you to say, but I think I'll reframe it and say that I have value in some spaces. So I really try to make sure that what I say yes to is something that truly should be done by me and that I would be able to do it well. And saying no is often because I don't think I would have value in that space, or I think someone else would be a better fit. And so by saying no, I'm actually elevating somebody else. Mm-hmm. So it's not that I've always known my value at large, but I think over time I've been able to figure out where my specific experience and expertise can come in handy. And I've gotten mm-hmm. better about recognizing what does and does not fit into that space.
Mm-hmm. Lots of food for thought.
So I guess just shifting from some of those early lessons learned, speaking of lessons, you really went right into that whole education thing. So you, after running the program for a little while, you got your doctorate degree. And I think we're just really curious about that whole process. You were still serving as a program director. And so there's a few questions we have here. First of all, I guess, what's the difference just on a, you know, simple level between the ED and like a PhD in terms of, you know, what that educational process is like?
Sure. And that is a great question. So yes, to clarify, my degree is an EDD, not a PhD. And the distinction often varies from one university to another, or even from one state to another. But at large, an EDD is typically for practitioners, meaning people who are actually practicing in the space of education, while a PhD would be for researchers, people who are studying education. So in my program, there were a lot of people who were high school principals or university deans, people that were really living and breathing the higher education world through their own practice. So that was the right fit for me. It also happened to be the doctoral degree that was available to me at BU. I'm glad it fit, but that's the distinction.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. So yeah, what was at that point in your life, what was the big motivating factor to pursue this?
Sure. So really, I just wanted to be better at my own job. And it wasn't that I was thinking of changing jobs or shifting my career trajectory, but imposter syndrome is something I know you all have talked about extensively. And that's the idea that people may think that they're just out there faking it and the world is going to figure it out and deem them a fraud at some point. That's very real, but there were absolutely parts of my job or roles within my job where I truly was not as prepared as I should have been. And I think that is probably very typical for people who work in higher ed, where you wear tons of hats. So it wasn't imposter syndrome. It was literally that I needed to be better in the skills in certain domains. So I started taking one class at a time. I wasn't aiming for a degree, but for instance, in the research space, while I wasn't the primary overseer of the research arm of the program, I was certainly mentoring student research projects, and I wanted to feel more equipped with both quantitative and qualitative research, study design and methodology. So I loved the courses in research. Similarly, a lot of the courses available were around organizational analysis or positive psychology and ways that you can have your leadership be more effective for your whole team. And as the director of the program, I thought I really owe it to my crew to be good in these spaces. So that was the impetus behind signing up for classes at the beginning. And then after I got a few semesters in, I thought, well, I'll apply, and kind of like starting the genetic counseling program, like, let's see how it goes. If I finish, great. If I don't, I will have gotten better at these various tasks along the way. I had one child at the time and then was shortly thereafter pregnant with my second. And I think in many ways, the chaos of that stage of life made it so adding on something else wasn't really going to change things. In fact, if anything, it gave me part of myself back because it allowed me to have adult conversations two nights a week. And I treasured those. I just can't tell you how much I loved the classes I took and the students I took them with. And then I blinked and 4.5 years had gone by and I got a degree.
Wow. How do you think since then it's helped you most in terms of being a program director?
I get that question a lot, especially from people who are thinking about going back to school and ask, you know, is it worth it? Should I do it? I think it very much depends on what your career goals are. So if, like me, you just want to be better at your current job, then by all means, continuing ed is an amazing opportunity that many of us have if we're associated with a university or even just working in a space where that is allowed as protected time, mm-hmm. or there might be some educational funding or benefits. So if it's going to make you better at your current job, go for it. If it's going to open doors to a new career that, or not even a new career, to new roles and jobs that you wouldn't otherwise have available, mm-hmm. then go for it. And that used to be the case where in order to be a PI on a study or apply for grants, you had to have a doctoral degree. Yeah. But that's changing. And I'm not sure that that's mm-hmm. reason enough. But I would say the two big things are if you think it's going to make you either better or more engaged and satisfied in your current job, or if you think it's going to open yeah. doors that aren't currently open, those would be the two reasons yeah. to do it.
One last question about this, because I feel like some people that, you know, might be considering an additional degree while working might have to like advocate for themselves to be able to sort of do this additional research or, you know, take additional classes. It sounds like maybe that wasn't the case for you since you were sort of like piecemealing it, at least at the beginning. But do you have any suggestions mm-hmm. or like know of how people have been successful at that in the past?
Yeah. So at BU, at least in the School of Ed, all the classes started at 4 p.m. or later because most people were working a job at the same time. And so it was the idea that if they had all these people from education, they wanted them to be able to keep their job if possible. And they would allow you to use your job as the backbone of all of your projects. So I did my dissertation in my own backyard, and it was really lovely to be able to make my own program and the Division of Graduate Medical Sciences better because of the classes that I was taking. So as long as it's a win-win, then I think it's easy to get them on board. If it's not as apparent what they're going to get out of it, I do think you need to make a business case and explain what the return on investment is, why it is going to make you a more qualified employee. Even if it's getting at, you know, your own trajectory within the organization or company, what other roles and titles you would be eligible for. A lot of times employers will just ask themselves, is this person going to stay around long enough for me to reap the benefits of this education? So you're going to want to explain that you do plan on staying.
So, you know, I think one thing that we would love to talk to you about, to the extent you feel comfortable, is you made a really big career move, talking about making, you know, moves. A point, you know, when we were actually in the BU program. And so, you know, we, I think, experienced this to some extent with you, this big career change. And so you ended up taking a job with the Stanford Genetic Counseling Program. And, you know, you can kind of explain if you want how, you know, what played into that decision. But yeah, I think we're just interested in, you know, what toll that decision-making process took on you. Because decisions like that, I know we know that, you know, especially for someone like you, they're not taken lightly. But I think for anyone who is considering one of these like massive career changes, that can just be a lot to think about at once. So I think we're just curious what your thought process was.
Sure. So for the record, making that announcement to my students at BU was probably the hardest thing I have ever done professionally. And I may still be a tad scarred. And that's because the biggest loss of that move was my people. You know, like Boston and BU was where I cut my teeth, both as a program director and as a parent. And so the thought of uprooting my life after such a critical stage just felt almost impossible. But that being said, I knew by the time I made the decision that it was what was best for my family. And in turn, what's best for my family is what's best for me. So there were a lot of pieces of that. One, I felt like I had likely taught my group as much as I had to teach them. And I probably had learned from them about as much as I had to learn. So I wanted to continue growing and I wanted to learn from colleagues that had different expertise. So the idea of going to Stanford, where there were so many genetic counselors who specialized in a lot of unique areas, was exciting. The idea that the person I was going to be co-directors with had such a rich, deep experience in research and ethics, which were two spaces I did not. And she was very eager to learn from my mm-hmm. background in education and professional development. So it felt very much like the puzzle piece fitting into place. And that has mm-hmm. proven to be the case. Like, I still every day feel like there's some new space that I want to dip my toe into. Finding the time to do that continues to be the challenge, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's how the last stage of my career unfolds, is just getting into some of these newer arenas that were never even on my radar before, because I did feel like I was wearing more hats at BU, and at Stanford, I was able to tailor yeah. that a little bit more. And then personally, the weather certainly didn't hurt, but a lot of it too was we had family on the West Coast, and the idea of having our kids grow up near aunts and uncles and cousins and grandparents was really appealing. So I do love that we can be outside all the time and don't really have to make contingency plans based on weather. On the other hand, you know, we could have a massive earthquake or the state could burn down. So those are clearly risks I'm willing to take.
Well, we're yeah. so glad to hear that, like, you know, you made that decision, because it sounds like, you know, you absolutely made the right decision for you. And there's like so many more opportunities out there for you, especially for the place that you're in right now. And it just, it makes us so happy. We were yeah. obviously devastated, but we forgive you.
yeah.
Thank you.
I think that actually watching you announcing that to such a big group of people and knowing that that was not a late decision actually in and of itself was an educational experience, like, or a professional development experience, I think, for us, because, you know, we knew how seriously you took that role. And I think it taught us about, yeah, having those boundaries. You always had spoken so highly of having a really great work-life balance, and we knew how important your family was to you. And so I think you practicing what you had been preaching to us and living that truth was actually really a important thing for all of us to see, as much as it like was like, oh my gosh, this is going to be different. Mm-hmm. I think now that I'm further in my career, I think it's made career moves that I've made less scary, because I'm like, oh, well, Marianne was leading an entire program and she left. And like, yeah. that was what was right for you. And I think it helps me put that into context, you know, like, what is actually, like, I genuinely thought about this with my last career change, like, what is going to be right for me? And that, yeah, that was just so important to see happen in front of our eyes at a stage where we were not yet really starting our, you know, end careers or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very generous of you to say. Thank you for that.
But there has to be something that you miss from the East Coast, right? Like, there's got to be like your favorite bagel place or.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Well, like I said, the people the people in my life at that stage will never be replaced. And that's not to say that I don't love my community out here, but I do think there is something about that life stage that just is so forever ingrained in your DNA. So the people is part one. Believe it or not, I would say the other big thing is public transit. And I know everyone complains about the tea, but I haven't driven to work in 20 years. I bike to work, and I can still bike to work, and that's awesome. But I wish there were easier options for getting to places that are further away. Mm-hmm. And we have the Caltrain, and we have some other things, but it's not the T. And I loved the T.
Yeah, I do think that you are maybe one of the few that will say that. But actually, Deanna says that too.
I love it. I think it's the best public transportation system. It's Me not too. Complicated. I did get on the Green Line like last year or something after not riding it for a while, and I definitely felt sick. Like, I don't know how I did this, like, jam-packed in a car every morning for years. But
yeah. Yeah. It's nice when it's, you know, the red line's like, you know, staying, you know, fine and not on fire. Things like that. But yeah, that's like part of the excitement of it, right?
Yeah. Totally.
Well, speaking of, I will also say we often talk about how we were just tougher back then. Mm-hmm. Like we were stronger, tougher people because you had to be. The weather was hard. The traffic was hard. The crowds and noise and all the things were hard. And life is easier out here and that's good. But I feel like I'm softer now. And that's unfortunate.
But you probably have like better soles of your shoes now. Because like, yes. I feel like in Boston, the soles of my shoes would wear down like within a few months because you walk so much.
That is true. Well, you know, I think that actually, you know, is a good segue because, you know, you say that you're less tough, but, you know, another experience that I think we felt along with you was, you know, a really difficult time when you told us that you had come down with leukemia. And I think we're, you know, that happened pretty soon after that move in the grand scheme of things. And so I think, you know, you have spoken on a larger platform, even with the full National Society of Genetic Counselors entering a webinar about receiving this diagnosis. But it's now been a few years now, and we are just so happy to, you know, be speaking to you and having the privilege to maybe hear some things from you about, you know, what it really focusing more on, not what that time was like, but really what it's been like after and how it's been jumping back into your career and feeling maybe more like yourself. I don't know.
I'm not sure even where to start with this one. I am 3 years out, which from a, you know, survival curve standpoint, it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
And it feels great. And my health, as far as we can tell, is excellent. But I've never really allowed myself to think much beyond the year at hand. So, you know, getting to year one felt like a victory. So did year two, so did year three. And a couple of weeks ago, I got to go to a stem cell and bone marrow transplant reunion at Stanford, where over 400 patients came back, including, wait for it, patient number one, whose transplant was 35 years ago.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Mind blowing. And that was the first time it ever dawned on me I might live that much longer. And I've been grappling with that recently. And I love that my experience has made me more present. And I do not think a whole heck of a lot about the future or the past. But that did give me some permission to start imagining a bigger future than I had previously. Mm-hmm. So in the last couple of weeks, I have tried to reflect on what is different now compared to at the beginning. I think I immediately knew if I was ever given the luxury of going back to work, that I would never work nights and weekends ever again. And I don't think I really had done much of that. But it was a firm conviction.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say in the, you know, the, with the idea that my job is, requires flexibility, right? It certainly doesn't mean that it's exactly 9 to 5, but it does mean that since then I'm not willing to do more than 40 hours a week. I just won't. Mm-hmm. My heart, my soul, my body won't allow it. And I think that's a bit of a luxury. And while I've stayed with that, I have started to worry that I will go back to sweating the small stuff and that I will take for granted the gift of time that I have been given. So I'm trying to really put my finger on how to make sure that doesn't happen. I know that everyone struggles with that and no one wants to get caught up in the minutiae and bureaucracy and red tape of life, but I really don't want to. So I would say that's one piece that has changed. But going back to work made me feel like a functioning adult again. And that was a really big deal. Like I remember having a very visceral reaction when my in-laws offered to find someone that could come help around the house or help the kids with their homework. And this was very early after my diagnosis, but I was like, absolutely not. Like that is my job. I am their mom. I will be the one to do that. And it felt similar in my career, and that being an advisor and a mentor was something I just felt like I need this back for me, not mm-hmm. just to contribute to the mission of the program, but I need it for my own identity. So I did go back part-time at the beginning and then very slowly increased back up, and I'm now 100%, but that's a pretty firm cap. I mm-hmm. have no interest in doing more than that.
Yeah. But I guess like, so it sounds like you're not quite at the point where you're thinking about how it will change your career sort of long-term, but do you feel like in those mentoring conversations that you have with people, like your perspective has changed in any way? Like it must have changed to some extent, but do you like notice yourself sort of like mentoring people in different ways now that you've had this really transformative experience yourself?
I don't know that it has. I think it has absolutely changed the way I engage with work and the things that I choose to spend time on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'm happy to say that as a mentor, I'm pretty much the same I was almost 20 years ago.
Wow. Love that.
Well, I also feel like it was really ingrained in me from my own childhood. It was the way my parents navigated their relationship with me. So I feel like when I am meeting with a student, my kind of singular goal is to make sure that they see the very best version of themselves reflected back in our conversation. And they may not be that person in that moment, but if they walk away feeling like they can become that person and they have the tools and they're empowered, and again, getting back at like agency and self-efficacy, then I feel like I've done my job.
I feel like I'm going to cry.
I can see both Deanna. Our faces are becoming flushed. I'm sweating profusely. That was beautiful. Because I definitely have been on the other side of that, and you do it beautifully. And I mm-hmm. think that's what makes you special as a mentor. So I think it's also that you put so much thought into it and there's so much intention into it. But it's you know, what leads us to our next question is, you know, at this point, you now have led two programs, and we were brainstorming this question. We were like, she kind of has a fan base, like, you know, like at that point when you've mentored so many people, you've changed a lot of lives, and you have helped many people realize that best version of themselves. And so, yeah, I guess when did you realize that maybe you had this effect on people or had that kind of power or influence to help people realize that about themselves? Is that something that you even consciously like realized mm-hmm. or just kind of happened?
Well, I think the few aha moments I've had related to this are when I see the downstream effects. So I'll meet new prospective students and they've been mentored by one of my alumni, and I can see so much coming through that ripple effect, and that makes me feel like on some small level that was a contribution I made to not just the next generation but the generation after that.
I guess, does it ever like stress you out though? Like do you feel like you have so many people sort of like coming to you for that mentorship and guidance. Like, do you get energy from it, or is it something that?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And make no mistake, I get advice and mentorship from so many of them too. So it is not a unilateral hierarchical relationship.
Mm-hmm,
To this day, some of my dearest friends and colleagues were former students, and I have learned as much from them as they ever learned from me. So it is selfishly speaking, it is the fuel that keeps my fire going, and probably why I will be in a role like this until I retire.
Yeah. Well, we, in the interest of protecting all of our time, I don't want to, you know, even though this has been a beautiful conversation, I don't want to, you know, take up too much. But before we get into maybe our favorite part, which is our rapid fire round, we do ask everyone two questions at the end. So what have you been most proud of in your career, and what are you most looking forward to in the future?
Most proud of is probably obvious. That's my alumni. And that's certainly not suggesting that I take credit for any of their successes, but it's just been a privilege to be part of the journey and kind of bear witness to what they've done. So I feel like the tapestry of my own career is a lot more colorful because of those people. Other than that, I would say probably the work that I've done on burnout with my friend and collaborator, Colleen Kalashew. So between our papers and presentations, I would like to think that we've gotten the message out there to hundreds of genetic counselors who will now recognize the correlates and consequences of burnout and potentially enact some strategies to mitigate those risks. Because I am worried about the sustainability of our profession. And I think if we don't address that, then we're going to be in big trouble. So really happy to have been part of that conversation.
And in the future, what are you most looking forward to?
Well, at some point, I would like to think that I can start to take more classes and teach more classes in other spaces. So I'd love to teach a class in the School of Ed on faculty development. I'd love to work in the coaching center. I have been the beneficiary of coaching, and I just find it incredibly powerful. So I guess I would say continuing to develop my own skills in new spaces is what I look forward to.
Any chance you'll be running for president anytime?
NSGC
president by president.
You know, it was a tremendous honor to be slated a few years ago, and I will never forget that feeling. But I would say, at least as of now, I feel like our field needs someone very different from me at the helm. So I want to continue contributing in the lanes where I know my expertise is needed, but I don't think that's the space for my voice. And there are so many other voices that we need at that table.
I really appreciate that answer.
I think it's time.
Okay.
Our favorite set of questions. Promise they're not too hard, and most of them are fun, but some might make you think. So the first question we have, what is your favorite time of day?
Oh, 9 p.m. My husband would tell you it's like a massive alarm goes off in my head that says it is time to get in bed and snuggle with the dog and read a book.
Aww.
And short of the house being on fire, that is what I do at 9 p.m.
I love that. What song do you listen to when you want to get pumped up?
In anything from Taylor Swift.
Great.
Sorry, are you losing it right now? What's your favorite?
Yes. On the new album, I really like the one called Question. It's got a good beat, and it fits nicely into my running mix. But there's so many.
I'm a big Karma person right now.
Yeah, my 10-year-old's a big Karma person too. In life and with Taylor Swift.
Our next question was actually sent in from a listener. Megan Grove. Megan Grove sent this in.
Hilarious. Okay.
And I believe it actually came from Brene Brown, which is just very fitting,
yes,
given that it's you. So what is something that people often get wrong about you?
First of all, I love Brene Brown and all of her podcasts and all of her books. I bet that people, at least those who don't know me, would think I'm an eternal optimist and that the glass is always half full. And I don't think that's true. Interestingly, though, I did one of those StrengthsFinder inventories that I hadn't done before. It's called the VIA Virtues in Action. And my top two were hope and perseverance. And I feel like that, like, it was a like mind blown moment where that explained so much of the way I kind of regroup when things don't go well, because I do on some subconscious level believe that things can turn around, but it doesn't mean I'm optimistic in every moment. My dissertation advisor gave me the compliment that probably has meant the most in my life. And she said, you believe in good outcomes and you will them to be so. And while that's inherently not true, I do think I just believe that you can hold space for the good and the bad, the gratitude and the joy, along with the loss and the grief. They can exist simultaneously. They don't have to, it doesn't, life does not have to be a roller coaster. So I think people assume that I am always optimistic, and that's not true, but I'm holding space for the good and the bad at the same time.
Love that. All right. If you could have any other career, what would you do?
Well, the answer for my whole life was I wanted to be a backup dancer, especially for Tina Turner. And I finally got to see her in concert about 15 years ago. And even then I thought I could have done this. I could have figured out how to do this. I love dancing. I'm not particularly good at it or coordinated, but that is the alternative career that I always wanted. Now I would say the more realistic one is to own a bakery and a bookstore. And I could see that happening at some point. That brings me joy.
Marianne's Bakery has a ring.
Thanks.
Call it 9 p.m. And it's just all the cozy things you love
about
them.
I love that.
Me too.
Next question is about your email signature. It says, be a lifeboat, lamp, or ladder.
Yeah.
Or something similar to that, something to that effect. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah. You know, that's been with me for a long time. I don't think there is anything that has been more impactful. It's a Rumi quote. And my thought is, in every interaction I have the option of helping lift someone out of the deep troubled waters, climb up to somewhere that they are trying to go, or shed light on a situation. And I can't be all three at all times, but I can probably be one at any moment. So that's been a big influence on my mentoring style too.
All right. And last question from the rapid fire. If you could change one decision in your life, what would it be?
Okay. There is a reason that we're asking this, because you actually asked me this in the interview. You asked me this question and it stuck with me. And I remember that was like one of the main reasons we like connected, and I, you know, I wanted to come to BU. So I figured tables have turned.
Yes. Well, I have to explain why I asked you that question. So I had a friend who worked in HR, and he told me that that was the most discerning question you could ask. Because if someone says, do you want to hear about the four from this morning? Then you know that they're reflective enough to be able to live with the uncertainty of whether a choice was good or bad. But if someone has to think for 6 minutes just to come up with some really big decision from 5 or 10 years ago, then they probably aren't comfortable in that nuance. So I still to this day use that question all the time. So I don't think I would have asked you the decision in your lifetime, but just a decision. You know, tell me about it.
That was my ad lib. Dana did not put that in the question.
So I don't know that I could answer that of my whole lifetime, but I've definitely made a lot of decisions recently that I regret. One is the shoes that I wore the other day because they hurt my feet. And I've decided you have to wear comfortable shoes. You deserve it in life.
Yes.
I feel the same way about your bed. If you have the luxury to own shoes and have a bed, they should feel comfortable. I ate some leftover food because I hate to throw food away. And I regretted it the minute I started because it was terrible the first time. That's probably one of my bigger personality traits that I don't love. I feel like in a previous life, I lived through the Great Depression or something, where I save all scrap paper. I save all food. I hate waste of any kind, but sometimes you got to let things go. So those are my most recent decisions I have regretted.
I love it. And now we all have a way to ace that interview question.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, I guess we always like to wrap up our interviews and just ask you if there's anything you'd like to talk about, any charities, businesses, organizations, pieces of legislation, something that you feel really passionate about that you'd like anyone who's listening to know more about.
You bet. So getting back to my leukemia, I think the organization I owe it all to is Be the Match. So that's the National Bone Marrow Donor Program, and they work with international programs. My donor was from Germany. So by the time I was able to connect with him, I think I had to go through like 6 different coordinating centers, and it's just miraculous that there's a universal system in place that works that well. So love what they do. Mm-hmm. Related to that, the governor of California just signed a bill into law that will make it so that adults who visit the DMV will be asked to check a box to join the registry. And if they check yes, just like you would check for a, you know, organ donor, then they'll give you a cheek swab then and there. And it just, I immediately started sobbing when I heard that, because I thought even just within the state of California, the number of new donors that should add to the registry is unfathomable. So it's called Charlie's Law. It's named after this, I think he was a district attorney that had leukemia. And he, while he was in the hospital, he worked with legislators to write this bill and get it passed.
That's amazing.
Yep.
Wow.
So if you're not registered and you can be registered, check out Be the Match.
All right. Well, this was just the best conversation. Thank you so much. And I think after everything that we've talked about, I feel so much joy and privilege that you decided to take time out of your day to spend it with us. This was just really special to have this conversation and to learn some of these things about you that we never knew.
Well, it filled my cup as well. So thank you again.
If you would like to nominate someone to be on our podcast, please reach out to us via Twitter or Instagram at RoseanneDNA or our website, RoseanneDNA.com.
And in the meantime, be well, be empowered, and cheers. Cheers.